From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. This week, we explored why we feel such anger toward people who disagree with us politically. Maybe you have a sibling or a coworker or a parent who votes very differently than you do. Odds are you view them as being uneducated or reckless or even a bad person.
Our guest was the philosopher Robert Talese, who has written a new book called Overdoing Democracy. He contends that when we only associate with people who agree with us, we become more extreme in our views. Here he is explaining what he means by overdoing democracy.
One of the things that makes democracy both great but also hard to love is that in a democracy, we're political equals. We each have an equal say in major political decisions affecting all of our lives. The equality part is what makes democracy great. What makes democracy hard to love is that sometimes our fellow citizens are not as well informed from our perspective, are not as reasonable from our perspective, are not as judicious from our perspective as we would like them to be. And sometimes our fellow citizens who fit these descriptions outnumber us, and so they get their way. The challenge of democracy is to be able to regard those with whom we severely politically disagree as nonetheless entitled to political equality, entitled to an equal say. That is, the ability to see those with whom we disagree politically as nevertheless our political equals. What makes this particularly challenging is that we as creatures are vulnerable to a particular kind of cognitive phenomenon. That is, when we engage only with the people with whom we agree, we tend to turn into, before our eyes and imperceptibly to ourselves, more extreme versions of ourselves. And when we become more extreme versions of ourselves, we become less and less able to see why those with whom we disagree are nonetheless our equals. That is to say that hiving off into like-minded bubbles makes it harder for us to preserve within ourselves the capacity to perform democratic citizenship properly.
I want to key in on an important point that Robert's making here in terms of how we sort of self-sort, because we've talked about how it's obvious that friendship groups tend to be rather similarly structured political. Even neighborhoods or where we live, and there's that interesting metric going back to 1976, Jimmy Carter won the presidency, and I think 28% of American counties were what we call landslide counties, where the presidential winner in that particular county won by 20 points or more. So 28% landslide counties in 1976. Donald Trump wins the presidency 40 years later, and it's more than 60%.
That's right.
We are less likely to even have neighbors who disagree with us. But on a recent podcast, you talked about how even the stores we go in or the companies we support,
yes,
where we buy a truck, where we buy a coffee. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So what we're seeing is, particularly in the past 20, 25 years, is what I call in the book, Overdoing Democracy, the political saturation of our social environments, by which I mean the phenomena whereby our social environments, our everyday casual encounters with strangers online at the grocery store, for example, are structured in ways that are not always easy to see by our political allegiances. So just to give one, I think, obvious example of this, just contrast what it's like to be in a Starbucks with what it's like to be in a Dunkin' Donuts. Starbucks is catering to a clientele that imagines itself as a cosmopolitan coffee drinker. The interior of the stores is designed to give you the momentary illusion of speaking a different language and being in a different part of the world. Contrast that with Dunkin' Donuts, where the slogan is, America runs on Dunkin'. These are two very different kinds of demographic appeals. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, Dunkin' Donuts tends to skew in its clientele conservative. These are people who want value, not the illusion of being in a foreign nation. They associate coffee drinking with working, with getting to work and being able to put in a good day's work. Starbucks clientele skews liberal, cosmopolitan values. They understand that the word venti is a word that means 20 in Italian. And so that's just one example. We can also look at grocery stores, Whole Foods versus ShopRite, or in my part of the country, Kroger. These also have very different kinds. They set up the environment very differently to appeal to a different kind of clientele. So our consumer behavior clearly is shaped by and marketed to us by means of an appeal to our political allegiances. And that's not all. Workplaces have become, over the past 20 years, more politically homogeneous. Families have become more politically homogeneous. Professions have become more politically homogeneous. It's very likely, for example, that your dentist is liberal, but your surgeon is conservative.
We're going to turn now to a conversation that might be difficult for some listeners to hear. Our guest was Heath Phillips, a veteran of the U.S. Navy who was repeatedly sexually assaulted. He joined the Navy at the age of 17 in 1988. Phillips reported numerous incidents of assault, only to be told that he must be homesick and that sexual assault doesn't happen in the military.
Phillips quit the Navy and was dishonorably discharged. He became an alcoholic, but after years of joblessness, he got sober. Earlier this year, the Navy upgraded his discharge to honorable and acknowledged the sexual assaults he suffered. In this clip, you'll hear Phillips describing the worst of the attacks. We warn you again that this can be difficult to hear.
I tried telling people, listen, I fought back, and if I fought back, the more I fought back, the more violent they assaulted me. You know, it was all just dominating me. So I got to the point, my ship would leave. It would like go on a weekend excursion down to Virginia or something. So I would go AWOL, and I would still be on base. I would just wait for my ship to leave, and I'd turn myself in. My ship would come back, and I'd report back to the ship, and I was not getting in trouble for this. And it came to the point that these guys decided that the worst game, worst thing that they could ever do. So I'm showering, and they pull me out of the shower, and I'm trying to fight back, and it's kind of hard. You're naked. I still only weighed like 120 pounds. So they get me down to the ground, and they're repeatedly kicking me. And then there's a guy, he got on my back, and he kept banging the side of my head against the floor, the deck. Just kept banging it and banging. And I remember always seeing like these bright star lights, you know, flashing. And then he stopped hitting me, but he still had my head pinned. And he had his knee right in the crook of my neck. And I just remember I couldn't move. You know, I can move my feet, but I just couldn't move. And I heard one of the guys saying something about shoving this inside him. And they tried sodomizing me with my shampoo bottle. And then the guy basically said that he was going to rape me. And you felt the pressure. You felt the feeling of a guy getting on top of you. And then nothing. I didn't feel anything. I just felt his body weight. And then he got up and he started kicking me. And apparently he couldn't get himself aroused and he was mad. So he ended up walking away. And then a few minutes later, one of the worst pains still to the day, I felt like my insides were being ripped out by a hot branding iron. And it was so bad that I passed out from it. And when I came to...
What did they use to sodomize you there?
A toilet brush.
A toilet brush.
Yes. They left it inside me, actually. That's when I came to, I reached back there, and it was still there. And I was covered in blood and feces and urine. And, you know, you're on a tiled floor, so, you know, it's like, you know what you're in. And I just remember, I was looking up, and there's a guy brushing his teeth, and he's looking at me, and I'm thinking to myself, God, please help me up. You know, I couldn't say it because nothing could come out. And I was like, in my head, God, please help me get up. And he wouldn't help me. And I ended up getting up. And my vision went to like a little pin vision. I don't know how to explain it besides, you know, like everything was just a circle in front of me. I walked all the way through my ship naked, covered in all this stuff with this toilet brush in my hand, all the way to medical because I was bleeding. And you know, I didn't know what to do. I get to medical. The guy's face was in shock. And he asked me to lean over the examining table. I remember leaning over, and he never put gloves on. He never touched me. He never did anything except for telling me, oh, well, I know what it is. You have a ruptured hemorrhoid. I'm like, no. These guys just did this to me. And he's like, no, they didn't do that. You have a ruptured hemorrhoid. It's what I'm writing down. In fact, you can have tomorrow off. And I'm like, I was confused. I remember standing up and grabbing this thing and just walking out while he's trying to tell me not to walk out. And I walked all the way down to the Master at Arms office. I didn't knock. I just walked in. And I didn't even get any words out. He's already had his hand up in the air going, whoa, 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 whoa. I've already talked to medical. I don't know why you're here. Nothing happened to you. And my eyes felt really funny. And I remember the feeling of like anger and this red, like he turned red. And I threw the toilet brush at him. Today it's funny, but then it wasn't. And I said a lot of rotten choice words to him. And I turned around, I walked out.
Next, we sat down with a Mexican journalist who advises news organizations on journalist safety. Javier Garza was in Rochester to speak to students at RIT. He's worked for newsrooms in Mexico that have been firebombed and sprayed with bullets by drug cartels. And he says the Mexican government rarely even investigates if a journalist is kidnapped or murdered.
We asked Garza how he views the situation in the United States, where journalists are rarely physically attacked, but are routinely described by President Trump as the enemy of the people.
I see parallels insofar as there is a global trend for political leaders and political actors to have paint or portray the media as enemies. Because we're not seeing this only in the United States. I mean, we're seeing this we just saw this in Brazil with the guy that won the presidential election. We've seen this in Mexico with Andrés Manuel López Obrador, president-elect, takes office in 3 weeks. And he rails against the media that he doesn't like the same way that Donald Trump rails against the New York Times or CNN. Whereas here, the president talks about fake media or failing media. In Mexico, the president-elect puts it more in a different tone. He talks about the bourgeois media as opposed to the interests of the people, for example. But it's in deep down, it's the same. It's just, you know, disparaging coverage that you don't like. And, you know, we're seeing this trend in other countries. I think it's a global trend fueled by the development of communications, the rise of the development of technology, communications technology, sorry, the rise of social media, political polarization, you know, different factors weighing in on this. In Mexico, it's different because we also have other factors, criminal organizations targeting the media, aided by impunity, by a weak rule of law that means that they can target and they can kill a journalist or beat or kidnap the journalist and get away with it because the guy that did it before got away with it. And so that's another force also playing against journalism. But I will say this about the United States. Big difference is that you can have the president of the United States rail against the media the way he does, and you can have the president of Mexico, say, rail against the media the way he does, or any other hostile actor against the media. If follower of the president of the United States would start to take that into a physical action, you know, like, say, beat up a journalist or, as we just saw, deliver a bomb to a news organization, he would get arrested, right, as happened. Here. And that would give the next guy who's thinking about this maybe some pause that it's probably not a good idea to do it, right? That doesn't happen in Mexico. If somebody were to take, you know, physical action against a journalist or against the news organization, odds are nothing would happen to that person. And that's the big difference, I think, between Mexico and the United States.
Finally, how do you think you would do on a quiz asking you to determine which statements are fact-based and which are opinion-based? It turns out that the older you are, the worse you will do. Pew Research found that Americans under the age of 50 did much better than Americans over the age of 50. Older adults are more likely to think an opinion statement, such as government is always wasteful, is a fact-based statement.
But why is that? In this clip, you'll hear Evan read one of the test questions from Pew Research. Then you'll hear insight from Quenisha Anye, a Rochesterian who sees a generational divide in how many sources of information we're accessing for news and opinion.
On the factual side, here is a question in which the 18 to 49-year-old cohort did significantly better than the 50 and over cohort. In fact, this is the question that both sides did the worst. But if you're over the age of 50, 48% understood that what I'm about to read is a factual statement. This is not an opinion. This is a factually based statement. If you're 18 to 49, 60% understood it, but only 48% over the age of 50. Here's the statement. Immigrants who are in the United States illegally have some rights under the Constitution. That's a factual statement.
Yes.
And if you're over the age of 50, you're more likely to think that's just an opinion.
Is it that you think it's an opinion or you don't want it to be true?
I think that's part of it. But I think the point that you've made so well, Quenisha, is that when you consume so much opinion, quote-unquote journalism or talk radio besides this one, or cable news programs at night, cable news especially, you start to think, well, I want this to be true. And, you know, darn it, it is. Mm-hmm. That's just the truth. And I think that you convince yourself, it's a pathological thing, that's the truth. That's the reality.
Right. And then you operate from that premise, right?
Yeah.
And that's where all of your privilege and everything else, you know, all these things come from that place. And you feel, you lose sight of the fact that this is now a feeling, right? And it feels informed because you're not just, it's not just you and your friends that are saying this. It's your friends are sharing an article from this not journalist on this TV network. And this is what is like true for like your reality. But, and then now you're marching and you're petitioning and you're doing all these things that feel tangible and feel real, but at the core of it, still false.
I think another problem with the media today is that they're setting the agenda, and they always have. A professor of mine at Syracuse University, Maxwell McCombs, and in the 60s, actually, before I went to college, he developed the agenda setting theory. And it's a social scientific theory. There's been over 400 studies similar to this. And it says that the media doesn't necessarily tell you what to think, but they tell you what to think about. So if they're covering the migrant caravan, and you're a 69-year-old conservative male, which I'm not, they think, well, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. We get those troops out there. We can't let these people in. Facts have nothing to do with it.
And then when it falls off the radar,
stop talking about it.
Especially like now when you keep hearing about this 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
I feel like if you were kind of aware over the last 3 years, let's say, mm-hmm. you started to feel when it got exhausting, like, wait, this is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And now it's literally just the norm. You know, I go on CNN or any of these like sites expecting the world to be on fire every time. Mm-hmm. I expect a new headline and that something terrible has happened, whether it's a mass murder or this person in office has done something insane or someone has been fired or left. Like, you don't go on there not expecting the worst case scenario. And so I think now we have, like you said, with the agenda setting theory, like you assume that when you go there, they're going to tell you something that you want to hear, that is true, and that you are going to act upon because everything is the worst it's ever been. You know, and I don't even know if we're at a point where they're not telling you what to think. I feel like I feel like now you have this war of media and they feel like, okay, the left did this or the right did this, we have to stand up. You know, it's very clear when you're watching the news who feels what. As much mm-hmm. as they try to use, like, general statements, you know who's a Republican, you know who's a Democrat, you know who they voted for, who they want to win. And I don't think that was always the case when you talk about a Walter Cronkite or plenty of people before now. And I think that we have just gotten to this, like, a really dangerous place.
And that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. Enjoy the snow, and we will talk to you Monday.